Hi, this is Paul, and this is a rough draft for Sunday where I walk through the current state of my sermon. Things may change between now and Sunday, and if you want to see what I did on Sunday, you can go to the church channel. The link is in the notes below, and you can see what I did on Sunday when I post it. I'm not always on time with that posting. Fasting. Fasting often has a religious connotation, but it is back in the news because Silicon Valley execs don't eat for days. It's not dieting, it's biohacking. And this very interesting article in The Guardian on the 5-2 diet. And I listen to tech podcasts, and I live near Silicon Valley, so this stuff is in the news, and these guys talking about how basically, they stop eating and it helps their health and it helps them their bodies and it helps them focus and it helps them get hyper productive and all of these things happening. It's very interesting because fasting has obviously been a practice that has been in religious communities for years. Traditional religious communities practice it. There are days of fast. There are periods of fast. Lent is a fasting period. Roman Catholics for a long time didn't eat any meat on Fridays, and so fasting has long been a part of religious activities and communities. And now suddenly here in secular Silicon Valley, they're practicing in order to do what, well, secularists would do, less food, less body fat, so on and so forth, exploring that. Now, One of the guys I've been listening to on YouTube lately is John Vervaeke, and he's been doing this very interesting series on awakening from the meaning crisis. And John teaches more Buddhism than Christianity, but it's one of the ideas that I've gleaned from his videos has been this ideas of psychotechnology, and these were ways that we, in a sense, hacked our brains, hacked our psyches. Psyche is the word in the New Testament often for soul or self. It's obviously the root word of psychological or psychiatric. And we hack our psyches in order to see the world in different ways. And we have these psychotechnologies that dramatically changes what human beings have done over time. And traditional religious practice has in fact had a lot of psychotechnologies. It helps you see the world in a different way. It helps your implicit pattern recognition capacities look at other patterns to see different aspects of reality that your, in a sense, your normal or your daily or your common observational skills would miss. And religious groups, once you begin to get an idea of what he's talking about in psychotechnology, you start reading the Bible and you start realizing, oh my goodness, this stuff is all over the place. Prayer is in some ways can be a psychotechnology where we break the normal practice and we get into a different mental space. Singing can be a powerful one. It just changes our view of the world. Music, architecture, you go into a building and suddenly things are changed. Fasting is one, obviously, where you can bring into different modes of consciousness by fasting, and that's what the Silicon Valley people are doing. Marching, you can take individuals, and part of the reason that they train soldiers with marching is they get them to move as a unit. You can do that with music and a band, and you get them to play as a unit, and you unlock different psychotechnologies, giving, releasing yourself from acquisitiveness, mushrooms, psychedelic drugs, sweat lodges, initiation rites, mutilation, hair shirts, medieval Christianity, they would practice self-flagellation, and you do this to get yourself into a different state of mind, to see the world in a different way. Solitude. Don't talk to anyone for days on end. Stay all by yourself. Isolate yourself. You'll get into a different state of mind. Meditation. All traditional religious practice have been practicing these psychotechnologies in many, many different times and places. Now, if you look at the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia on fasting, you'll see some pretty typical things. Deliberate and sustained abstinence from all foods for a specific period of time. A fast may be associated with private acts of piety, the acknowledgement of disaster, emotional disturbance, mourning, repentance, or it can be a form of public devotion. Biblical writers accept the social and religious concepts as facts without discussing the origin of the custom. Moses fasted at Sinai to receive the law. Now, one of the things that obviously, in terms of being a Christian and growing up in the Christian church, even a Protestant tradition that doesn't focus very much on fasting, you know, it's around and maybe you've dabbled in it and you've practiced it a little bit, or maybe it's a part of your regular religious piety. But one of the things that the psychotechnology idea kind of flipped my mind on it, because I had always, fasting for me was always embedded in a very relational situation, and my assumptions that I just kind of picked up and absorbed and come up was that this fasting was, in a sense, well, if I want something from God, I'll pray for it. If I really want something from God, I have to show that I'm serious about it. You know, it's almost like a kid holding his breath and until he turns blue, or some political protester going on a hunger strike, that this was a way of kind of upping the heat on God. And for this reason, you know, I think in the Protestant world, in fact, early Reformed Christians in the Reformation era were known as sausage eaters, because while the Roman Catholics were fasting, Christians were exhorting, were practicing their Christian liberty. And so the kind of in-your-face anti-Catholics would eat a sausage in front of a poor, starving, fasting Catholic. And this had obviously been a practice throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament period. Paul conducts a fast. Jesus fasts 40 days in the wilderness. But when you apply the psychotechnology, you kind of flip the script on fasting and see it not as so much a kind of a way to manipulate God or coerce God, but actually a way of actually strengthening yourself to pray better and see God. And so in a strange way, the Silicon Valley experience and the psychotechnology term kind of opens up new ideas for me about, well, what is fasting and what is it for and what does it enable? And I had heard many people say things like, well, Jesus fasted 40 days in the wilderness in order to battle Satan, to strengthen him. And it was really some of these new ideas came and said, oh, I guess I can kind of see that, where you would fast in order not to somehow beg or manipulate God, but in order to actually be in a better state of mind. And we experience this with some of these other psychotechnologies of prayer and singing and doing things communally. It strengthens us. And many Christians will say when they leave worship on Sunday, they feel recharged and ready to go back to life again and ready to face the challenges. And so these psychotechnologies sort of do that. Now, one of the things that this fasting slide shows with that in the Israelite history, they were proclaimed in response to national emergencies often or distress. And there were a number of fasts that came in during the Babylonian destruction of the temple that had been instituted. And one of the interesting passages out of the prophet Zechariah is this. The word of the Lord came to me. This is what the Lord Almighty says. The fasts of the 4th, 5th, 7th, and 10th month, and you have to do a little research to figure out what those were, usually connected with the Babylonian destruction of the temple, will become joyful and glad occasions and happy festivals for Judah. Something is flipping the script on these fasts. Therefore, love, truth, and peace. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Many peoples and the inhabitants of many cities will yet come, and the inhabitants of one city will go to another and say, let us go at once to entreat the Lord and seek the Lord Almighty. I myself am going, and many peoples and powerful nations will come to Jerusalem to seek the Lord Almighty and entreat him. And actually, you can see that happening today. All of these, for centuries now, people have gone to Jerusalem, to this holy place, in order to seek the Lord. And here the prophet Zechariah is talking about this in a day when Jerusalem was humbled and destroyed by the Babylonian destruction of the city, and even in the post-exilic period was just a shadow of what it had been, let's say, during David and Solomon's time. And it was the center of this small empire there in this middle land between the great empires of Egypt and the Mesopotamian empires. And here's this prophecy that somehow it will be restored, and these periods of fast where they mourn the loss of the temple will be turned to rejoicing. Well, what does that mean? Something has happened, and someone has come, or something has happened, and the script has turned, and they're fasting, their sorrow now is grounds for celebration. This is what the Lord Almighty says. In those days, 10 people from all languages and nations will take hold of one Jew by the hem of his robe and saying, give us a tour of the Holy Land. And say, let us go with you because we have heard that God is with you. What is this? This people who are at the low end of the status hierarchy will suddenly be at the top because they have access to this God. Now, what we've seen in Jesus in the Gospel of Mark is this, it's almost like this explosion of Jesus' celebrity on the landscape of Galilee. He becomes an instant celebrity and everybody wants to have a piece of him. And you almost feel the Zechariah prophecy coming true right there. He calls life out of the chaos with his words. He makes the unclean clean with his touch. He summons working men and they drop everything just to be near him. The crowd is so eager to get near, he doesn't get a moment to himself. People take apart his roof just to drop their paralytic friend into his midst. And the leaders are made nervous by him and criticize, sometimes out of jealousy, sometimes because they don't want someone not of their cadre having so much power. That's potentially dangerous and unstable. And you'll see this happen when someone gains high celebrity in a big crowd quickly. If the person isn't right in tune with exactly what they think needs to be said, they'll attack him. Mark 2:18. And John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. And they came and said to him, why do the disciples of John and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples don't fast? Fasting is a normal part of what it means to be a good Jew. The Jews fast on Monday and Wednesday. And in fact, the Didache will later say, don't be like them. Fast on our Monday and Thursday. Don't be like them. Fast on Wednesday and Friday. But Jesus' disciples aren't fasting at all. And well, again, this is disturbing. You're breaking with tradition. And you're not only breaking with tradition of the Pharisees and the scribes and the religious observance, but you're breaking tradition with John the Baptist, who we kind of associated with you. And Jesus said to them, the bridegroom's attendants are not able to fast while the bridegroom is with them, are they? As long a time as they have the bridegroom with them, they are not able to fast. But days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and they will fast in that day. Now, there's two strange things about that. It's not that he says they shouldn't fast. That's implied here. But that they're not able to fast. Some power has taken hold of them that even if they had wanted to fast out of religious compulsion or obligation or tradition, they can't because the bridegroom, well, who's the bridegroom? Now, obviously, what we have in a sense here is there's going to be three metaphors, three word pictures that Jesus works in succession. And the first one is a wedding banquet. And what's really interesting about this wedding banquet idea is that this is something Jesus goes to quite regularly. In fact, it'll figure prominently into his messages of heaven and hell, in that the wedding banquet, well, he's the groom and the church is the bride. The book of Revelation will pick this up. But now at the wedding banquet, they're not able to fast. Something has taken a hold of them. Something is possessing them. Something has them. But there'll come a day when the bridegroom is taken away, and the language there implies some force. But it's also couched in that day. That's a key word. That's a key phrase. And you almost have a day of the Lord theme going on here. So in other words, the point that Jesus is making is timing. That, well, John the Baptist comes and we've all got to repent because, you know, God is coming and he's going to be a scourge. And so you'd better get your house in order and get ready because you don't want to be found unprepared. Well, Jesus will make comments like that eventually. The Pharisees are like, well, we've got to clean up this place so God can bless us. God won't bless no mess. And Jesus said, no, that's not the time right now. my disciples are not able to fast. Now, when the day comes, well, what day is that? The day of the Lord. When that day comes, now, I've talked about that day quite a bit. That's a complicated idea. The day of the Lord is both the day of judgment and the day of deliverance all together. And it's Good Friday and Easter all smacked together. Well, in that day, in that day, they won't fast when the bridegroom is snatched from them. Then he gives us two more quick word pictures in succession. No one sews a patch of unshrunken cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the patch pulls away from it, the new from the old, and the tear becomes worse. Now, this is just something common that all of them would understand. If you've got new cloth that has not been experienced the washing and the duration, that cloth will shrink. And then it actually, trying to put that cloth on old, will tear the garment. And everybody knew that because that was something that they were familiar with. Now, so much of our fabrics are engineered so that they don't change so much in the wet and the wetting and the drying and the sun and all of that. And so they're much more stable, but no, something like that, it'll shrink and, you know, it'll shrink up. And so you can't put unshrunken cloth on an old garment because it'll shrink and then it'll tear at the fabrics. And the second illustration, and no one puts new wine in old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the wineskin, and the wine is destroyed, and the wineskin too. But new wine is put in new wineskin. Now, here's a little graphic that shows what they do. They would take a new wineskin, and they'd put the grape juice in there, and the grapes are crushed, and they begin to ferment. The yeast turns the natural sugars and the grape juice into alcohol and carbon dioxide, and in the process, the skin expands. So you need a new skin that still has elasticity in it, and then the skin will look like this. Now, if you try to put the grape juice that's going to ferment into the old wineskin, it bursts, and you lose both the wineskin that you could reuse for old wine or for water or for whatever you needed to use it for. But if you use it in that way, you lose them both. What is Jesus saying? Because he connects it with the fasting and then the cloth and then the wineskin. Well, Jesus is saying a new day has come and it's right here with me. And it's fundamentally different from all the old, ordinary, common things that you have ever experienced in your world. And that is why my disciples are unable to fast. He's not taking fasting off the table completely. He's saying, when the bridegroom is taken from them, they will fast. But right now, they just can't do it. Well, that's strange. Now, one thing I hear, and actually, those of you who are following the Jordan Peterson Verveke stuff, in this conversation, Peterson basically alluded to it. Something I hear often from people is something like this. It says, you know, okay, Pastor, I don't believe in the resurrection, but I'll give you the resurrection, okay? So let's suppose Jesus actually rose from the dead and walked out of the tomb. And let's suppose I'll even give you the ascension. That Jesus went up into a mountain and he flew and he got hid in the clouds. So what? Armies still ravage and burn and kill. People still die of cancer. Hunger and famine still go. Jesus' resurrection changed nothing. I still have unhappiness. I still have all of the vagaries of my life. Lots of things go wrong. Jesus' resurrection saved nothing, changed nothing. Well, it changed the minds and hearts and behavior of the people that believed it. And in fact, N.T. Wright, in his book, The Resurrection of the Son of God, basically asserts that the only way to account for the development of Christianity is that his disciples actually believed he rose from the dead and touched him. And that's actually one of the best arguments for the historicity of the resurrection, which is the actual development of Christianity. And even skeptics like Bart Ehrman who don't believe in the resurrection will say, well, the disciples thought they saw something. They sure believed it. They weren't making this up. This wasn't a hoax. And so, well, maybe it changed the hearts of the people who believed, but people still die. and armies still ravage, and hunger and cancer and rape and abuse and neglect and sorrow and depression, and all those things are still here. And so what on earth did Jesus' resurrection accomplish? That's a good question. I thought Jesus was supposed to change all this, and he didn't. So let's move on and change it ourselves. Now, here's a question of, what world do you want to live in? We're really pretty bad choosers. But you do get a fair degree of choice. And so what we do use is we use these psychotechnologies, and we try to shape the world that we live in. And now the more psychotechnologies we have and the more regular technology we have, people are spending all of their time on their cell phones, or spending all of their time playing computer games to get them into a flow state, or spending their time watching Netflix, where they can, in a sense, virtually realize the stories of others and enjoy that. And we have drugs and alcohol and other ways to get us into other states so that we don't feel the pain and we don't suffer. And if it gets bad enough, well, maybe the doctors someday will allow us to just lay down, and they'll give us a drug like Brave New World and Soma, and we'll lay down and we'll just be in bliss, and then we'll die. The irony is that the affluence in our new digital age seems to mean more distraction and less meaning, and so we'll just distract ourselves to death. But now Jesus comes and says, the new age begins with me. The age to come starts with me. And while we certainly await the consummation, Jesus finally defeating sin and death and the ending of the rebellion that separates hell on earth, that separates heaven and earth, where Jesus' prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven, finally gets fully realized, we're not there yet. And what Christianity has always believed is that we're in an in-between state right now. But notice, something happens to his disciples in that in-between state. It's Jesus' presence, and it's so contagious, it's so powerful, they probably were feeling heaven on earth. And we know that. We feel that in different ways. Falling in love is sort of a window into deliverance presence. And there are millions of sappy songs and movies that bear witness to that. You're the meaning in my life. You're my inspiration. You complete me. And Rose says of Jack in the movie Titanic, he saved me in every way a woman can be saved. You know that when you fall in love, that suddenly everything seems new. And all of the problems in the world seem to go away, and all you desire is to be in the presence of that beloved. And when you're in the presence of that beloved, all the other problems of the world seem to be gone. And you say, yeah, Pastor, I know, but it doesn't last. Well then maybe you get a car, and so for that moment or those first few days of driving that new car, oh, it's all great, but then it doesn't last. Or maybe it's you longed and longed to get a job, and then you got the job, but then it doesn't last. And so it's just one after another, and so we get these little foretastes of pleasure and escape, but it doesn't last. C.S. Lewis in The Problem of Pain makes this point. The Christian doctrine of suffering explains, I believe, a very curious fact about the world we live in. The settled happiness and security which we all desire, God withholds from us by the very nature of the world. But joy, pleasure, and merriment, he scatters broadcast. We are never safe, but we have plenty of fun and some ecstasy. It's not hard to see why. The security we crave would teach us to rest our hearts in this world and oppose an obstacle to our return to God. A few moments of happy love, a landscape, a symphony, a merry meeting with our friends, a bath, or a football match have no such tendency. Our Father refreshes us on the journey with some pleasant inns, but will not encourage us to mistake them for home. In those moments when Jesus is healing the sick and casting out demons and raising the dead, time stood still, and we saw the kingdom. And we knew the Mount of Transfiguration. Peter says, let's build shelters. Let's live here. And Jesus says, not yet. I want you to have a taste for the home that is to come, but not yet. You're not able to fast on the Mount of Transfiguration. You're not able to fast while Jesus is wreaking havoc and the kingdom of God is being realized in the midst of the people in Capernaum. Everyone's tasting it, and everybody wants more, but not yet. Not yet. Why not yet? Why not yet? Why can't this world stay saved? Mr. Incredible asks. I have to clean it all up again. Well, at some point we have to turn and look at ourselves and recognize that the problem isn't out there. The problem is in me. And I need to not just look at Jesus and say, Jesus, fix this up. But I need to look at Jesus and say, Jesus, fix me up. I am the problem with this world. We remain in the shadowlands. The resurrection shows us it has begun. The Holy Spirit is a guarantee. The church is to encourage us. We wait and long for that day. Jesus will give samples of the age to come, and the disciples cannot fast while the samples are before them. But we must stop and recognize, which is exactly what the cross does, that I am the problem. The problem isn't out there, in my circumstance, in the government, in other people, in the other political party. The problem is in me. I need to change. That's what Paul says in the book of Romans. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what they already have? So here we are. So how do we respond? We seek the presence of the King. We do so in prayer. You can do so in fasting. Do so in Bible reading. We do so in fellowship with believers. We do so by doing what He did, sharing good news with the poor and the lost, relieving suffering. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.